AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
Hey everyone, Homes.com knows having the right agent can make or break your home search. That's why they provide home shoppers with an agent directory that gives you a detailed look at each agent's experience, like the number of closed sales in a specific neighborhood, average price range, and more. It lets you easily connect with all the agents in the area you're searching so you can find the right agent with the right experience and ultimately the right home for you. Homes.com, we've done your homework. Hi, folks. This is Chuck here. Welcome to the Saturday Selects edition of Stuff You Should Know. This week, I am picking out the cheesiest SYSK episode ever from August 25th, 2011. And this is not a show about bad music, but this is a show about cheese. I love cheese. Josh loves cheese. A lot of people love cheese. And this ended up being a very dense, probably could have been a two-parter, but a really cool episode about the history of cheese and how it's made and just the varieties of cheese. Like, you could have an entire 14-part series on cheese, but as we do, we decided to cram as much as we could into one episode. So pour up some wine, cut some cheese, metaphorically, or actually not metaphorically, and enjoy this episode.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. With me, as always, is Charles W. So Funny Chuck Bryant.
Is that a new nickname? So Funny Chuck? Mm-hmm. My wife would beg to differ. She might say I'm not so funny sometimes. No? Okay.
So, Chuck.
Yes.
How you doing?
I'm great.
I've got an intro this time.
Awesome.
How long has it been?
I don't know.
It's been a while.
Really?
Yeah.
Since we've had a proper intro?
Yes.
Okay.
If you ask me. So, let me paint the picture for you.
All right.
In May of 2010, a little newspaper called The Telegraph, I believe out of London,
yeah,
published an article about a recent survey of 4,000 consumers, British consumers, of what were the top 100 most important inventions ever created by man.
Okay.
So some of them are not surprising. The wheel came in first place, right?
Beer.
Beer is on there, and it came in, was it on there? I don't know. I can tell you painkillers were on there in 13th place, 15th place. But no, man, I didn't see beer on here, and surely it is.
Maybe that was just they don't consider that an invention.
Sliced bread came in 70th place. The iPhone came in 8th place.
What?
Ahead of the combustion engine.
That's ridiculous.
In 87th place came calendars.
Okay.
But then right after that, in 88th place came the cheese grater.
Hmm.
Yeah.
The grater.
The cheese grater. That makes me think. So first of all, this is clearly one of the dumbest assemblages of 4,000 people ever put together. Calendar and then cheese grater.
And then iPhone number
yeah.
8.
Yeah. So I think that possibly, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt, and that they didn't assume that cheese was invented by humans. The cheese grater was clearly invented by humans. You don't find them growing on trees.
Yeah.
Cheese, apparently, you find growing on trees. It's a gift from God.
Right.
But I think had the pollsters said, you know, I just want to remind you here that cheese is an invention.
It would
have scored higher, at least 88. It would have at least replaced the cheese grater.
Oh, yeah. I would. No, England, I don't know how they are on cheese, but the EU is real big on cheese.
It is.
As a whole.
So is Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So is, well, California. Yeah, the EU.
Yeah.
Yeah. New York.
I think Germany and...
it's in the EU.
France.
Greece.
Denmark. Belgium. They're all like in the top 10.
Yes.
Greece is way ahead, of course.
And well, Greece comes up in some stats that are coming up right after this. But, Chuck, cheese is an invention, and as legend goes, an accidental invention, right?
Yeah. I mean, I've seen it dated back to prehistory, so they can't obviously trace it back to 6000 BC and say how it happened, right?
Well, they can say that it was around at least as late as 3200 BC, because it's, right. It was found in the tomb of one of the Egyptian pharaohs, cheese, 5,000-year-old cheese.
Yeah.
Which, wow. The idea goes, the legend goes, that there was some shepherd, some goat herder, some cow herder, which I guess you'd call a rancher, went to, I guess, go tend to his flock. And he had his daily milk, and he used a cow skin, or a cow stomach, a calf stomach specifically, to store the milk. And when he went to go drink it, it came out all curdled and smacked his face. And he said, "What is going on here?" He told some people about it, and it took root.
Now, see, I read that Roquefort was invented by accident by a shepherd.
Yes, I read that too.
And he stashed his lunch in a cave because he saw a young maiden that he wanted to go get down with, and he forgot about his lunch and came back like a couple weeks later and it was moldy.
Yeah.
And he ate it anyway and was like, "Hey, this is pretty tasty."
Yeah, he's like, "I like this a lot."
So that makes me think these tales might be just intermingling some.
Well, they are tales. There's nothing, you know, specific, nothing documented.
It's fun.
But Roquefort also supposedly is from, it dates to about the time of Christ. So if cheese was known to the Egyptians in 3200 BC, and it would have come before that. But it's possible they were invented independently, accidentally, right?
That's true.
There are a lot of shepherds running around at that time, a lot more than these days.
That's true. And Roquefort is also a PDO, which is a protected designation of origin cheese.
That's true, man.
Which means it's got to be made in Roquefort-sur-Solzon.
Right. And specifically this mountain range, this small area of mountaintop.
Got to get the sheep from there.
In France.
Got to age it in the caves there.
Yep.
Or you're not eating Roquefort.
And still to this day, speaking of how Roquefort is produced, these shepherds that still kind of dress like they used to during medieval times.
Like Little Bo Peep?
Kind of. but they all have beards. It's really kind of disturbing to go to this area. The families make the cheese from their own flock's milk and then take it to the caves where it's purchased by affineurs, which are expert finishers of cheese in France.
Which means they just sit around and look at it.
Yeah. They're like, "Come on, hurry up.
The cheese is done."
So that's just a brief sketch of cheese history, right?
Yeah, and that's the most interesting stuff, I would think.
All right, well, that's the podcast.
All right.
Well, let's talk cheese, man. You know these stats are interesting.
Yeah, in 2009, the average American consumed, or the Americans consumed an average, depending on which way you want to look at it, of 32.9 pounds a couple of years ago per person per year.
Say that one more time.
32.9 pounds. Let's just call it 33 pounds of cheese per person per year. I love cheese, but I don't think I eat that much.
I had no idea I was eating that much cheese.
I might be, though, dude. I love cheese.
I'm going to start paying attention. I'm going to do a yearly cheese count.
Ugh.
Also, this, what was it, like 33 pounds? Per American per year of cheese?
Yeah, give or take a few ounces.
That's part of 82 billion pounds of cheese that America alone produces, or produced, I should say, in 2008. And get this.
82 billion?
82 billion pounds.
I got like 8 different stats on that.
Yeah, there's a lot of different stats out there. It's true.
I got from 9 billion down to 10.1 million.
So I got 82 billion.
Wow, we're all over the place with that one.
I suddenly am like really... Well, okay. This is from like a cheese board.
Okay.
Probably Wisconsin. It probably would have been like the Delaware cheese board. I'm not listening to this. In 1975, we ate 14 pounds of cheese a person.
So we've doubled our cheese intake.
Yeah.
Since 75.
That's really something.
What year were you born?
76.
Might have something to do with it.
I knew I was destined for something.
But the Greeks are up to close to 60 pounds a year.
Yeah, the Greeks and the French apparently score between 53 to 73 pounds on average per person. The Greeks and the French are tied as the world's greatest consumers of cheese.
It's a lot of feta.
That is. And feta is probably the oldest cheese, by the way, speaking of cheese history. It's also one of the simplest.
Yeah. I love crumbly, delicious feta.
Right. Feta, if you went to Greece and made and grabbed some feta that some Greek shepherd farmer had just made, and you brought it back to the U.S., they would slap the cuffs on you. The FDA would.
Oh, because it's the aging laws we have here are different?
Yeah, it's a raw milk cheese.
Yeah.
And which means it's made from, it's a fresh kind of cheese made from unpasteurized milk. And in the U.S., if you make that kind of cheese, if you make cheese using pasteurized milk,
yeah.
You have to age it 60 days at least.
Unpasteurized milk. Yeah.
So this is just this, like, we just stepped into this fascinating world, if you ask me.
Yeah, pasteurization, just quickly, is, most people know, is when you take food, usually a liquid, though, and you heat it up really hot for a specific amount of time at a specific temperature, then you cool it down real quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal there is to slow down microbial growth, but not stop it.
Right.
Because that would be sterilization.
Huh.
And not pasteurization.
Right. Named after the great Louis Pasteur.
Yeah. And if you don't want to sterilize it because that ruins the flavor. So
that's, I would imagine.
Yeah.
Sterilized milk.
Sterilized cheese.
Yeah.
Gross.
It's not good stuff. But not only is pasteurization good for your health, most would say.
Yeah.
While cheese connoisseurs, like the hardcore kind that have like mohawks with like Elmer's glue, right?
Sure.
They will tell you that the only good cheese comes from cheese made from unpasteurized milk.
Yeah, raw milk cheese.
Yeah. But other people will tell you, you're not really right. We can make really good cheese with pasteurized milk. And pasteurized milk makes for an easier cheese making process. It's more reliable. It's more predictable.
Yeah. And when you're making tons, metric tons of cheese, you want something consistent like that.
Right.
All right. What a wham bang start. Why you talk about milk all the time with cheese, Josh?
Well, because cheese is really just a portable form of milk.
Yeah.
You know, it's basically, it's like grain represents virtual water.
Sure.
You ship grain from one place to another. You're really shipping the water that was used to produce the grain in addition to it.
Yeah, I remember seeing those commercials, like, I think it was Kraft, like, there are 2 cups of milk in every slice of Kraft American cheese. And I always thought, that's impossible.
Yeah.
Look at it, that little slice of cheese, and look at 2 cups of milk. There's no way.
You're probably right, though.
No, they can't say that. They're the second biggest food company on the planet.
I think they can do whatever they want. Yeah.
So you're right, Josh.
Buy and sell, you and me.
Milk, cheese is nothing but milk. Milk is about 80% water. If you remove this water, you got cheese, basically.
Yeah.
It's a little more complicated than that, but
it's not that much more complicated.
No, really.
I was really surprised. Like, both of us apparently went our own way and learned how to make cheese. And I have to say, like, I am strongly considering getting me and Yumi into cheese making.
You can make mozzarella pretty easily.
Yeah, but I'm not big. I'm okay on mozzarella. I like a good mozzarella.
Yeah.
But more I'm into like the slightly stinkier cheeses.
I don't know if you can pull off making like a Limburger.
Well, I wouldn't make that, but I could make like a Gouda or a Chèvre.
Chèvre.
Yeah. I like that too.
Speaking of Limburger, quickly, I don't remember the name of the bacteria, but the bacteria used in making Limburger is the same one on our body that creates body odor, which is why it stinks.
I read that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why people say it smells like feet, because
right.
It does.
Yes. And scientifically speaking, you're absolutely right. Everybody, it's time you heard about Squarespace. Squarespace has the tools you need to create and sell your own website, whether it's an online course or custom merch.
Squarespace has you covered.
That's right. Courses is a great program. You can start with a professional layout that fits your brand, upload video lessons to teach techniques and skills, and tailor your course with a powerful Fluid Engine editor.
That's right. With Fluid Engine, which is a next-generation website design system, by the way, it's never been easier for anyone to unlock unbreakable creativity.
That's right. And don't forget the commerce side, because after that, you can charge a one-time fee or you can even sell a subscription.
Yeah. So turn your creativity into income with Squarespace courses. And right now, go to squarespace.com/stuff for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, use offer code STUFF to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Squarespace. All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on.
Types of cheese? Should we break that down real quick?
Yes, we should, because there's a big contentious debate about how you classify cheese. And this guy, Stephen Jenkins, for this article, seems to have a pretty good handle on how cheese should be classified.
Josh, he's a member of the Confrérie des Chevaliers du Test de Fromage.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Very nice. Which I was looking at that like, I wonder if I'm going to have to handle that one.
It's cheese connoisseurs, and he's an expert, and he says you can break them down into fresh, soft-ripened, wash-rind, natural-rind, blue-veined, uncooked-pressed, cooked-pressed, and processed.
And Chuck, like we were talking about already, the fresh cheeses, those are the easiest, the most basic, the most ancient kind. You've got your feta, you have a queso fresco, mascarpone, right? Not mascarpone.
Yeah.
The R goes after the S, so it's mascarpone.
I wonder why that is always mispronounced.
I have no idea.
I thought it was mascarpone until I read it, and I was like, huh.
That rolls off the tongue, though, more than the R's rolls off the tongue more than the zzzr.
Mascarpone.
Yeah.
Which isn't even really cheese technically, right?
No, it isn't. It's you skim the cream off of the top of the Parmesan making process and add a culture to it and you got mascarpone.
Rigotte, also known as ricotta, but if you're from New Jersey you might say rigotte.
Okay.
And cream cheese, obviously.
Yeah.
And I think you mentioned queso fresco, right?
Yes.
Those are fresh cheeses.
Yeah, those are the ones where you just basically go through step 1 through 3 of cheese making and then you just start eating it.
Yeah, and some of them still contain the liquid part, the whey.
Right.
And they don't keep very long. And that is fresh cheeses, which is why you got to eat them right away.
That's right. It's a portable way of preserving milk, but it's only preserving milk for like an extra day or two.
Yeah, it's very mild taste. Very milky.
Okay. Soft ripened cheeses.
Josh, they are semi-soft. A lot of times they have a white, bloomy rind. And we're talking brie, a little more flavorful and buttery, but still pretty mild.
Yeah, so the rind on brie specifically, or any kind of bloomy rind cheese, is made from bacteria, right?
There's a lot of bacteria going on with cheese.
Right. Well, they just rub bacteria on the outside of the cheese, maybe some salt, and then the bacteria starts to rot the cheese effectively from the outside in.
Very effectively.
So that's what the rind is.
Yeah.
Some people say you should eat the rind because it is cheese, but it's bacteria-laden cheese.
I eat the rind.
Do you? I usually don't.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I dive right into that brie.
And brie, as far as smell goes, is one of the milder bloomy rind cheeses. Most bloomy rind cheeses and most soft ripened cheeses are the stinky ones, like Stilton, which is the king of English cheeses.
I love me some Stilton.
Limburger.
Yeah.
Roquefort. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. So now we are at Waschrind. Those are the stinkiest of cheeses, Limburger. And if we mention some of these, it's because they overlap into different categories.
Right.
Waschrind means these usually have has a reddish-orange rind. And the stink comes from washing it most times in liquid, like brine or mm-hmm. wine or beer.
Yeah.
Makes it stinky.
You might make a wheel of cheese if it's a soft, ripened cheese and just throw it in like a brine bath and leave it for maybe 6 days per side. It's mm-hmm. going to float on top and then you flip it.
Yeah.
Leave it for another 6 days and you've got it washed.
And it stinks because of the mold and bacteria that grows because of that wash.
Yeah. And the beer and wine bath also came from the introductions of cheese to monks.
Oh,
who said,
yeah.
Hey, we make beer, we make wine, it's kind of what we contribute to the world. Plus,
sure.
We've got these caves, so, you know.
But you can't have a cocktail party without cheese.
Exactly. So there you go. That's where that comes from.
Natural rind, moving on, is heavier than most of other types of cheeses. It's aged, usually, because not all cheese is aged. A lot of them are made from raw milk, and again, English Stilton and Chèvre are natural rind cheeses. That's when the rind forms naturally.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes.
Okay.
So rind, I guess I should correct myself. The stinky ones almost always have some sort of bacterial-induced rind, whether it's
yeah.
hastened along by washing or it just happens naturally.
Right.
If you got a rind, usually going... If you have a moldy rind, you're going to have a stinkier cheese.
Okay.
Okay?
Yes.
And then... Where are we, Chuck?
Blue-veined.
Blue-veined, that's Roquefort, Gorgonzola, Maytag Blue. It's
these
exactly
are my favorites,
what it,
by the way.
Do you like these?
I love...
Blue cheese?
Love blue-veined cheese.
Yeah.
So eat it all day long.
It's exactly what it sounds like. Everybody's seen it. You know, you get a hunk of this, and it's just, like, crumbly, and it looks deteriorated.
So good.
But that blue or the green, the veins in it, is mold.
Yeah.
Pretty healthy, active, live mold, too.
Very tart. Like that's one of the cheeses that makes my jaw just go...
Do you eat it as a dessert cheese?
No, I don't do a ton of dessert cheeses.
Yeah.
Sometimes if I'm at, you know, a restaurant that has a nice dessert cheese menu. But I like the cheese and wine thing. We'll get to that, though.
Oh, okay. and then lastly, well, third to lastly, we've got the pressed cheeses, cooked and uncooked, right? So uncooked cheese is cheddar cheese.
Good old cheddar.
Just that orange block of cheese is uncooked, and cheddar is actually the name of a process of making cheese. Cheddaring is taking the curds and just pressing them down on top of one another until you squeeze all the way out.
Yeah, and these pressed cheeses are really dry because you're just getting... You're pressing the whey out, like you said, and that's the liquid. So
right.
It's going to be much drier, like your hard Parmigiano, Reggiano, cheddar.
Yeah. And,
what else?
And also, as a side note, orange cheese, like orange cheddar.
Yeah.
You know how it's like brilliantly orange sometimes? And you're like, that can't possibly be a real orange. What's going on there?
It's not.
Apparently, back in the day, in the spring and summer.
This is the fact of the show for me.
Is it?
I think so.
I would say the... 33 pounds per person of
That's the gross consumed. Fact of the show. But if you want to celebrate cheese at a cocktail party, just say what Josh is about to say.
I think you should take this thing.
No, I think you should.
Okay. Back in the day, if you had your flock out of sheep or goats or cows and it was spring or summer, they were chewing grass. When they ate grass, they were ingesting a lot of beta carotene, right?
And vitamin D, yeah.
Okay, which lent a lot of that stuff to the milk, which ultimately lent a lot of it to the cheese, which ultimately dyed it orange. And in the winter months, they were eating hay, which made kind of for paler, wan-looking cheese. It might have tasted as good, but people tended to prefer orange cheese. They just thought it was better. So over time, people said, well, we're just going to start dyeing all of our cheese orange. And that's where it came from. And to this day, apparently, it's just an open secret that among cheesemakers, you dye your cheese orange if you're making an orange cheese.
Fact of the show.
Yes. Beta carotene, grass, summer, spring.
History. So, like we said, those are the pressed cheeses, Gruyere, Reggiano. They're all pressed.
I love Gruyere.
It can be cooked or uncooked. Cheddar is uncooked, right? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But if you take the curds and you just press them, that's uncooked pressed, obviously enough. If you cook the curds and then press them, that's cooked pressed, and that's like Gruyere, Gouda.
Yeah, Parmesan.
Yeah.
Parmigiano, excuse me.
Provolone, the pasta filata, right?
Pasta fazool.
And then processed cheese, we have to mention.
We got to work our way down the cheese chain.
Yeah.
Yeah, processed cheese, technically, again, is not a cheese. It's a byproduct of the process. It can have cheese scraps, can have whey and cream and water, gums, dyes, other ingredients. You can work your way further down to easy cheese.
Yeah. Cheese Whiz, Velveeta.
Yes. You know when a cheese doesn't need to be refrigerated, that it's like, and it comes out of a propellant.
Yeah, I was going to say, if you have cheese in a can, that's a big giveaway usually.
Sodium citrate, sodium phosphate, calcium phosphate, sorbic acid, sodium alginate, I don't even know how to pronounce this, apocarotenol, annatto. These are all things in easy cheese. Cheese isn't easy, though. So I think that should be your other giveaway.
Yeah.
Cheese takes time.
Yes.
It's not easy. Although you think it's easy to make.
Although there is such a product as easy cheese, I believe.
No, that's what I'm saying. That's the stuff in the can.
Oh, okay.
That you squirt out onto a cracker.
So that's easy cheese.
That is the brand name.
Well, what's the one where the cheese is, it's like in a little plastic tray and the cheese is on one side, the crackers are on the other, and there's like that little red plastic spreader?
Spreader, yeah. That's some sort of processed cheese.
Okay.
Which is technically not cheese.
No. So there you go. Those
and also,
types, right?
You can make cheese from pretty much any kind of milk. Like traditionally, you've got cow, goat, sheep.
Buffalo.
But you can also make camel cheese and horse cheese and moose cheese. And I haven't had any of those.
Anything with nipples that's lactating, you can go ahead and milk and make cheese from.
Even just the little cat, you know? Yeah, camel cheese. I'm interested to try that. So maybe one day
someday.
Can make it happen.
So I don't know if anybody should try to mail that to us, though.
Camel cheese in the mail? No. I don't think so.
So speaking of lactating, right?
Yeah.
Let's talk about how cheese is made, Chuck.
Well, Josh, there's a lot of different ways to make cheese, depending on what kind of cheese. Like, it gets very specific, obviously. We can't say that you do this for 2 hours and age it for this long.
Right, right.
But there are four main stages, which is curdling or coagulating of the milk, shaping of the curds, draining of the curds, salting, washing, and seeding, and then maturing. And then we can get more detailed right now.
Somewhere in there is the running of the bulls.
So cheese, or I'm sorry, the milk comes in. It's got to be heated to a specific temperature.
Yes, because, again, milk is nothing but curds and whey. Right?
And you want to separate these. That's the first step.
Yeah, and the way to separate them is to create lactic acid. Milk is chock full of lactose.
Oh, yes.
But for it to lose its
sugar,
stability,
right?
It's a type of sugar. Yeah. It's a milk sugar. But for milk to lose its stability and break into curds, which are globby, semi-solid masses, and whey, which is like basically like milky water, you need to convert the lactose to lactic acid. So apparently lactose, the milk sugar, holds everything together. And to convert it to lactic acid, you introduce bacteria.
Yeah, there's a few different ways you can do it. It could be lemon juice or vinegar.
Yeah.
Or it can be an actual bacterial culture. And it doesn't take much of this. I saw the Dirty Jobs micro. Uh-huh. I mean, they had, I think it was a 5,000-pound batch of cheese that they were making, this huge vat of milk. And he added what looked like about the size of this mug of bacteria culture to it.
Yeah.
So it goes a long way.
Well, there's a lot to them. They're very small.
There's a whole lot going on there.
Yeah. So if you do use bacteria, you're probably going to use either a thermophilic, which is a heat-loving bacteria, or a mesophilic, which is like a kind of a warm, tepid temperature bacteria,
right?
But either way, they're going to go in there and they're going to go to town on the lactose and convert as a byproduct lactic acid, right? So
that's
then
right.
All of a sudden you have curdled milk. That's step one done. Step two is where that legend about that shepherd comes in.
Yeah, with rennet.
Yes.
Renneting.
Yes.
Rennetation. I don't know if that's a word.
What is rennet?
Rennet is enzymes from the stomach lining of the cow or a sheep or a goat.
Well, a young one.
A kid.
Yeah.
If you will.
Or a calf.
Well, you wouldn't want just some old cow's stomach lining anyway.
Well, it's not necessarily there anyway. The whole reason that this enzyme is in there is so a young cow can break down mother's milk and digest it.
Exactly. So when you add it to milk, Josh, it makes the casein into curds. And casein is one of the proteins in milk, and whey is the other one.
Gotcha?
Mm-hmm. Okay. And it is casein, so look that up. Well, there's other types of rennet, too, actually. There's vegetable rennet, everything from, like, sunflowers and ivy to papaya and mallow. But I don't know if the taste is the same. I guess it is.
No, I'm sure it's not the same. And I've also seen that papaya and pineapple doesn't work as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then if you use one like stinging nettle works really well, but you have to basically create like a brine that you introduce into the cheese so it affects the flavor, so you can only use it for certain kinds of cheese. But yes, if you are a vegetarian, there is such a thing as vegetarian cheese out there. And if you're not a vegetarian,
there's a lot of them.
There is calf's stomach in your cheese.
Yum.
But just a tiny bit. Apparently a thumbnail full is like the rule of thumb, excuse the pun.
So the coagulation period, it depends on what kind of cheese you're making, but sometimes it's as little as 30 minutes, sometimes it's as much as 36 hours.
But it sets. It's like chocolate mousse, you know?
It looks set, but it's sort of separate underneath. Like the top is solid.
Right.
And then you've got the whey underneath.
But if you apparently, well, there's plenty of whey still left in the stuff that's set too. But I guess if you stick your finger in there, this is what I've read, if you stick your finger in there and it comes out clean,
yeah,
then it's set.
It's like a pumpkin pie.
Right. Exactly.
Except you don't eat your finger.
No. So when you've got this thing set, you cut it with a thing called a harp, which is a curd cutting knife.
Yeah, it looks sort of like there's different ones, but a lot of them are made out of fishing line.
Yeah.
And so you're just, like a harp or guitar strings, you're just kind of gently passing it through, breaking it up.
And you're cutting it usually into like little cubes, half-inch cubes, that kind of thing, and that alone releases the whey.
Yeah.
Right? So you drain the whey off until you have just the curds, and then you cut. You either use large curds, smaller curds. You may cut the curds up some more. You may use them as they are right then. I think for mozzarella, that's about it.
Yeah, you want to keep the curds separate, though. Like, curds want to join back together.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe they have machines, but it's smaller dairies. You have, like, 6 or 8 people in there just churning the stuff up with their hands between their fingers.
Yeah.
Constantly.
Yeah.
And that's the hardest part, I think.
Yeah. So you got that. You got the curds separated from the whey. You're getting more and more whey out. And then you might cook the curds if it's a cooked type of cheese.
Right.
Like cooked pressed, like Gouda. You might just start mashing them together if it's cheddar. And then that stuff, the bacteria for cheeses like Stilton or Roquefort or whatever, the bacteria that you used as a starter starts to come into play.
Yeah.
Because now it's done being cooked, it's done being heated or warmed, and the bacteria is going to start to thrive because you're giving it a temperature. You're putting in a climate, I should say.
That it loves.
Where bacteria loves. Like cheese is, like when you first make cheese, it's not very tasty. It's kind of rubbery. You need to, if it is a ripened cheese, you need to let it ripen. And ripening is basically the further conversion of lactose to lactic acid by this bacteria over a period of like weeks or months or years.
Right.
And that gives the cheese its flavor. It's stink too. But that's what gives cheese its flavor is the activation of this bacteria.
That's right. Another thing that helps with the flavor and all cheese will have is salt. And salt does a few things. It speeds up the drying process. It enhances the flavor. It helps the rind to form if you need a rind. And it slows down the microbial growth, which is good.
Right.
But all cheese has salt. And it's added at different times, too, from what I've seen. Depending on what kind of cheese you're making. And sometimes it's straight up salt. Sometimes it's a briny wash.
Yeah.
So it all depends on what you're doing.
Yeah, when they make Roquefort again, they just take the wheel of cheese and rub salt on it, on the outside of it, until all the pores are closed. And then that creates the rind. That's the beginning of it. So you've got your cheese ripened. You've got it sitting in a cave-like environment, right?
Yeah, temperature and humidity are very important, down to the degree and percentage.
Mm-hmm.
Very controlled.
Yes. So before you stick it in the cave, Chuck, you might want to needle it, depending on what kind of cheese you're making, right?
Is it in the mold yet?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. It's in the mold. It's pressed.
Yeah.
If you're needling it, you probably... I don't know if you started to create the rind or not yet. Maybe you probably would. With needling in particular, blue vein cheese is your favorite. They really get their kickstart from this mold, this bacteria that loves oxygen. So you have to poke holes in the cheese, little tiny holes. This is needling.
Yeah.
And the bring the oxygen to the bacteria so they can create the mold.
Needling is not a nice thing to do unless you're making cheese.
That's true.
Or sewing, right. I guess.
So what you're doing is actually bringing the oxygen to the mold so it can turn into that great blue vein cheese, which is really, you realize it's rotted dairy is what a blue vein cheese is.
I know exactly what it is.
All right.
You don't like it?
No, I do.
Oh, okay.
I just wanted to make sure you knew what you were getting into.
Oh, I know.
So that's...
Some of them, I mean, some of the cheeses you can get are hairy moldy.
All right, game off. Let's pause here to talk more about Monopoly Go. Because in Monopoly Go, you can team up with your friends for timed tournaments where you work together to build up each other's boards. It's very nice.
That's right. And the more you win together, the more awesome prizes you unlock. And there's so much to get. I'm talking about unique stickers that you can trade with friends to complete albums for big prizes, cool new playing pieces to travel the boards with, or hilarious emojis for taunting friends when you smash their buildings or heist their vaults.
Plus, Monopoly Go feels new and exciting every day with constantly changing tournaments and challenges, like digging for treasure or a robot pachinko machine. And there's always new timed events that help you win big, like massive multipliers for everything you win or rent frenzies.
That's right. There's always something fun to discover in Monopoly Go. So get off the bench and go download it now for free on Google Play or the App Store. Game on.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. They push what technology can do so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com/welcome to now.
Yeah, have you heard of Kasumarzu?
Nuh-uh.
Okay. Prepare for this, man. Kasumarzu is made and illegal in Sardinia, Italy.
Okay.
And it's this type of cheese. It's a sheep's milk cheese, which makes it a pecorino because it's in Italy. That's what they call sheep's milk cheeses.
Right.
During the cheesemaking process, the cheesemakers, the underground cheesemakers,
right,
allow this type of fly called a cheese skipper to lay eggs, which become maggots, in the cheese.
Wow.
The maggots crawl through the cheese, eating the milk fat, and creating an enzyme that putrefies the cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Not just
stinking it up.
Molding, but putrefying it.
Yeah.
Now, if you, and apparently it's absolutely delicious. You can't necessarily compare it to a taste. I've read a couple things on it, and everybody says it's a sensation. It can burn the tongue, right?
Wow.
It's so acidic. But if you are really to eat Kasumarzu the right way,
mm-hmm,
you eat it with the live maggots on it. And these maggots can jump 6 inches off of the cheese. So if you can't stomach the idea of eating live maggots or don't want like digestive problems for the rest of your life,
right,
you will put a little bit of the cheese that you're going to eat in a paper bag, hold it up tight, and wait for the popping sound of the maggots jumping off the cheese to stop, which means they're all dead.
Awesome.
Then you can eat the cheese.
Would you eat that?
Totally.
I would too.
I would eat it with the dead maggots. I wouldn't try it.
Got to taste good. It's not like they're eating something disgusting. I mean, it sounds disgusting, but tastes disgusting.
No, I would definitely eat it without the maggots. If I had to, if the only way to try it was with the live maggots,
right,
I would. I would not be happy about it. I would strongly prefer eating it without the maggots.
Okay.
Yeah.
I just want to know.
So this is Kazumarzu, man. That in my opinion, really the coolest cheese ever created.
Now, that's just like cool cheese stuff, how to make it, what it is.
Types.
But if you're asking practicality, guys, where's my practicality in my daily cheese life, my cheesy life? Which, by the way, the etymology of that, I looked that up. They think that it's ironic reversal from 19th century British slang when cheesy meant fine and showy.
Huh.
So they think that's an ironic reversal. I don't know about that.
Yeah,
I think some sorority girl just said it and it caught wildfire.
Yeah, it seems like one of those kind of words, like cheesy. It was sitting there waiting for it to be picked up and used in that way.
Although it did in the 1896, apparently, the late 1800s, it meant cheap and inferior as slang in the United States.
Huh.
Something was cheesy.
So and then it died for a little while? For like
I don't
a
know.
Century?
Who knows?
Huh.
Anyway, I was curious about that. So, cutting the cheese, Josh. There are ways you should cut the cheese.
Okay.
I knew you would laugh at that. It depends on the shape and size. And this is all from cheese.com, by the way. Your cheese resource on the web.
Right.
You divide the cheese so that you get an equal share of the inside and the outside, if you want to do it properly.
Okay.
Makes sense. Round cheeses are cut in wedges, like a cake.
Yep.
Cheese bought in slices should be cut lengthwise.
Okay.
Not across. And tall truckles are easier if sliced horizontally.
Truckles?
Yeah, that's like a tall barrel cheese.
Okay.
That's like taller than it is wide.
Gotcha.
Not like a big wheel.
So it's a cylindrical cheese.
Yes. That's a truckle. matching cheese and wine, there are no hard and fast rules, but generally, whiter and fresher cheeses go with crisper and fruitier wines.
Yeah.
You're not a big wine guy.
No, I am. I enjoy wine with cheese.
Okay.
I'm into rosés.
That's right.
Right now.
Smooth, fatty cheese goes well with smooth,
fatty
slightly
wine.
Oily wine.
Wine with, like, globs of fat floating on top.
No, oily wine, though.
What's an oily wine?
Well, I can't think of one off the top of my head, but...
An oily wine?
Yeah.
Huh.
No?
I've never heard of it.
Sweet wine, Josh. Jerry's laughing. Contrasts with highly acidic cheese. White wines usually go better than red wines, even though I love my red wine with the cheese.
Yeah.
Dry, fresh wines are ideally suited to soft cheese, goat cheese.
Dry white?
Dry, fresh red.
Oh, okay.
Ideally suited to soft cheeses.
Gotcha.
You can also match cheese with beer and cider, obviously. And they say to try regional combinations. Like, if a wine is from a region and a cheese is from a region, chances are they probably go well together.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. It's a good rule to follow.
So I have a piece of advice based on my own experience. There is nothing better you can do for like an hour or a half hour, whatever you can get away with on like a Saturday afternoon when you have the time, than to go to a place that has like a real live cheese monger.
Yeah.
Who knows what they're talking about.
Oh yeah.
And going up to them and saying, hey, I really like this, this kind of block cheese I've been eating for a while, but I'm ready to expand my horizon. So can you introduce me to some?
And watch their eyes light up.
Yeah, they'll be very happy. They usually, you know, they'll cut you some samples. They'll kind of walk you through. And it's not ridiculously expensive. I mean, when you look at the per pound price, you're like $35, but you're not buying a pound. You just buy like a quarter of a pound usually is about the least you can get.
Sure.
But it lasts quite a while. So I strongly recommend if you're sitting there eating a block of orange cheese right now, go out and introduce yourself to the world of cheese, because there are some really awesome cheeses out there.
There are many good ones. And when you buy these cheeses, you might bring them home and the next day you found that they're all hard or they're not like they were when you bought it. And that's because you didn't store it properly.
Yeah.
And there are some tips here, Josh, for storage from cheese.com.
I could use them.
Unpasteurized cheese should be not sliced until it's purchased. So if you see it in a place and it's like sliced up, don't get it, because that's wrong.
Okay.
Keep the cheese in the condition in which it matures. So hard, semi-hard, and semi-soft cheeses should be stored in temperatures from about 8 to 13 degrees Celsius.
What is that in Fahrenheit?
I don't know. There's conversion tables on the web.
Okay.
Keep the cheese in wax paper, and put it in a loose-fitting food bag because you don't want it to lose humidity, but you still want to have air. You don't want it to dry out.
Gotcha.
So you got to keep that balance. Blue cheeses, you should wrap really all over because it'll jump onto other foods in your refrigerator, which you don't want. The mold will.
Yeah.
And it'll also infect the other foods with flavors that you might not want.
You don't want blue cheese eggs.
No. And you don't want your eggs to smell like your blue cheese.
Right.
Which makes sense. You should take the chilled cheeses out of the fridge about an hour to 2 hours before serving it. And wrap soft cheeses loosely. You don't want to wrap it in like plastic wrap really tight. Again, they recommend wax paper and like a loose Ziploc type thing.
You got anything else?
I mean, I've got random facts. Monterey Jack comes from David Jack, who lived in Monterey, California. Pretty easy.
There's answers.
And it's one of only four American Native American cheeses. I think it's Colby, Jack, Brick, and...
It's a Native American cheese?
Well, Native.
Like from Oklahoma?
It's not from Europe.
Gotcha.
Or wherever.
Colby, Jack,
Colby,
Cheddar?
Jack, Brick, and Cheddar.
Yeah.
I think of the four American cheeses.
Yeah.
And the U.S., guess the number one cheese that we produce in the U.S.
American cheese?
Nope.
Cheddar cheese?
That's number two.
Mozzarella?
Yep. Probably because of all the pizza.
Yep. That would definitely explain all the cheese consumption, too.
Huh? In Wisconsin, besides their awesome dairy land, they had a bunch of immigrants from Switzerland and Germany and Belgium and France that settled there. So that's kind of why it's the...
The Swiss in particular created the heart of the cheese trade in Wisconsin. They were doing it for themselves starting in like the 1830s. And or the 1840s, and by the 1870s, they were selling outside of the state. So it happened pretty quick.
Yeah.
The industrious Swiss,
they are industrious.
Yeah,
with their knives and cheese,
yeah.
They go well together.
Yeah, I know.
And finally, Josh, I would invest some money if you have any left over into Kraft, if you've got some just spare change laying around, because Asia is loving their cheese all of a sudden.
Oh yeah,
yeah, a continent typically not very cheesy. Not much Asian food has cheese.
It's probably due to the rise of the moneyed class in China.
Well, it's due to a rise in pizza and cheeseburgers, specifically.
Yeah.
They're loving pizza now, and apparently South Korea is the biggest buyer, and they're like, they've literally doubled and tripled their cheese imports in the past couple of years. So, big cheese eating going on over there now.
So, that's it for cheese, I guess. If you want to know more about cheese... There's a really good article on the site. Really, honestly, it's a good initial primer to get you ready to go to, you know, really learn how to make it yourself. You can just type plain old cheese, C-H-E-E-S-E, in the search bar at HowStuffWorks.com, which means now it's time for listener mail.
Spammy listener mail. That's what I'm calling this. Just heard your spam podcast. I worked at the Hormel Institute for 6 months after my PhD. You made a brief aside about the smell. Let me tell you something. It is like nothing on earth. On days that I followed the pigs to work, I would anticipate smelling a very pungent version of newly dead flesh. Then the next day, I would be overwhelmed by the smell of half-cooked meat. It's the most powerful smell, and 2 years on, I can still smell it. You could not escape it anywhere in the building, even in the back room of the lab. You mentioned the recession boosting the sales. I can attest that was the case. Thankfully, I was living upstream from the factory, though. So my house didn't smell of spam, but large portions of the town do actually smell of spam, particularly on certain production days. All joking aside, I was in love with Minnesota. I loved living in Austin and its people and would love to live there again in the future. I never made it to the museum where they give away spamples, but local restaurants had spam burgers, even though she didn't eat any. So it does stink as bad as you think, Josh.
I can imagine it would. Did you see the other person who's moved to Hawaii and has been documenting spam displays? And one of the things was macadamia nuts, but spam-flavored macadamia nuts.
I'd like to try that, actually.
I want to as well.
Yeah, whoever that is, please, or anyone in Hawaii, if you could send us some spam macadamia nuts.
Nice.
That would be good.
Okay.
So that's from Elizabeth, and she is a postdoctoral research associate in the bio department at... UMass Amherst.
UMass.
Smart lady.
That's a Pixies song, right?
It is.
Yeah. If you want to send Chuck and I a sample of your cheese, especially camel cheese, we want it. Email us and ask us where to send it to, right? Or if you have a cheese story, we want to hear it. That's just so wide open. There's got to be something good in there.
Wait.
Send us an email to stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
The first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. But you know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line, thanks to Visible. It's true. So switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. Switch now at Visible.com.
Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Altoids because, let's face it, unraveling the mysteries of the universe is tough work. But with Altoids, your breath will be stronger than a black hole's gravitational pull, more intense than an alien abduction, and more reliable than your phone's battery during a podcast marathon. When it comes to needing intense freshness, Altoids have you covered. Altoids are stronger than your favorite conspiracy theory, more intense than the latest true crime docuseries, and more reliable than a Bigfoot sighting. They're not just mints, they're curiously strong mints. Find Altoids in the checkout aisle. Grab your tin today.